Okay, so Christ is crucified. John is at the cross. Peter is not at the cross. So what does Christ, when the angel in the Gospel of Mark talks to the women and tells them that the Lord is risen, what does he specifically tell them to do? Tell the disciples and Peter. Why? Yeah, yes, right. You know, part of it is Peter's the leader, but it's like, and part of that is like, you're still the leader. You know, you messed up big time, but you're still the leader. And I love you enough to let you know specially that I'm thinking of you. You know, we all fall flat on our faces. Most of us do it on a very regular basis. It doesn't take Christ by surprise. You know, he knew before he ever said, let there be light, every single time I have fallen on my face and am falling on my face and I'm going to fall on my face. He knows. And he said, let there be light anyway. And he seeks us out in our fallenness to help us. And so, okay, so Peter hears this, that, you know, that the Lord is risen. And so what's he do?
Oh, will he go fishing?
Well, not yet. He hasn't seen Christ yet. So, but he's heard that the Lord is risen. So he runs to the tomb.
Oh, that's right.
Okay. So who else runs with him? Okay, so who gets there first? John gets there first. Who enters first?
Peter.
Okay, so one of the things that the fathers talk about is like that John is more discerning, but Peter is more zealous. Okay, so John was the one who knew, you know, I mean, he got there first. He knows the deal. But Peter, in his zealousness, is the one who enters first. And I think what's important about that, and part of what's important about that for us, is even with the great saints, they don't all have every single virtue to the same degree. You know, everybody has their own particular virtue that is very strong in them. And Peter is obviously zealous, obviously courageous. John is obviously very discerning and very loving. And we can learn from each other. You know, if you were Peter and you had John around, you could ask him, you know, like, who's going to betray him? You know, because he'll know, because he can ask. I wouldn't know to ask. You know, and if you were John and you had Peter around, you knew you had someone who would have your back. You know, and so for us to instead of being upset that so-and-so has this virtue or this quality that I don't, you know, it's like they have my back there. You know, I can't do this, but they can, and we're one with another, one with one another. Okay, so now, in recognizing Christ after the resurrection, now we're on the second draft of fish. And this also, there's just not time to go into all of this, this draft of fish is a more, it's sort of represents the end times, because it's not, in the first one, remember the net was almost breaking. Here the net doesn't break. There were all kinds of little fishes and big fishes, and you know, they sort of had to go through it. Here there were 153 big fish, and there's a whole bunch of different things that 153 means, and I didn't write any of them down, and I don't remember what they are. But the meal of fish that Christ gives them, is that from those 153 fish? No. So this is actually understood as a Eucharistic meal. You know, Christ is feeding them mystically. And he's the fish, right? I mean, that's in very early in Christianity, You have the word ichthos, which is an acronym for Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior, right? I think, yes. You know, and so I think for us, you know, one thing that we have to realize is that we're not healed outside of the Eucharist. You know, it was after that Christ came, after the resurrection, and fed them his own mystical meal that he then healed Peter of his threefold denial. And how does he do that? How does Christ heal Peter's threefold denial?
I thought that three different kinds of love. Do you love the three kinds of love?
Okay. So the three different times that he said love, some people make a big thing about the fact that the first two times Christ said it was the agape, and all three times Peter used like phileo, which is like a sort of, I guess, translated in English, friend. But interestingly enough, what little research I've been able to do, I don't see an ancient father who makes that point. And they're completely easily capable of making that point. And like St. John Chrysostom, I haven't noticed to make that point. And I'm not saying he never has, but I haven't noticed it. So I'm not sure how strong that is. And there also is the interesting thing that we constantly use the term for Christ, philanthropos, the friend of man. And so that's a very strong word. I mean, it doesn't have to be, but it. So I'm not exactly sure how important the difference in those words is, but I've heard that, and you know, but anyway, but the one thing that is clearly important is that Christ offers Peter three opportunities to say "I love you," you know, when, and that heals the denial. But, you know, that had to have been, and it obviously was, immensely painful for him. You know, by the third time, he's like, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And he must have been crushed. But again, you see, there's this whole thing, as you look at all of St. Peter's life, is he bears the discomfort and then the crushingness to our sin of holiness. And he wants to be with Christ so much that he will bear whatever he has to stay with him. And so he bears the threefold "I love you," which heals and brings very vividly to mind, it had to, the three denials. Okay, so now after that, after this threefold restoration, what does Jesus tell Peter? Oh, that's part of it, yes. And that's very important, because the thing is that the way you show your love, Peter, is you feed my lambs, you tend my sheep. Okay, so that's past, that has happened, and now Jesus tells Peter something else. He tells him how he's going to die.
Oh, that's right.
Okay? And he's, you know, he doesn't come right out and say it, but he is prophesying that he will be crucified. And Peter says what? What about?
Oh, John.
Right. What about this man? Now, you know, until I started reading up on this, I never even realized that this question, you know, this thing about the Christ telling him how he's going to die is actually still very much part of this whole process. Because what was it that Peter failed to do? He didn't go to the cross. He failed to die for Christ, which he had promised to do. So Christ, in his mercy, is saying, you're going to get to do what you promised to do. But it's not going to be by your power. And by this time, Peter knows that it's not by his power that he's going to get to do that. And so, you know, I think I've seen this in Chrysostom, where he says that when Peter is saying, what about this man, what he's actually asking is, you know, does he get such a wonderful honor too? Does he get to die for you? You know, and it's like, never in a million years is that what I would have been thinking. I mean, I would have been thinking, like, I have to die on a cross? Well, like, what about this guy? You know, does he get off? You know, so if I have to die a death like that, what about him? And see, you know, the thing is now he's seeing pretty straight. And now he realizes, like, if I want to follow Christ, I have to die with him. And that's not only what I have to do, that's the glory that I get, is to die with him. And because of that, and because if you love the Lord your God with all your mind and heart and strength, you will love your neighbor as yourself. And therefore, he wanted his good friend to have that same honor. Okay, so I'm a little bit over here, but I'm going to sum up in just a few minutes now. So I want to back up and just look at Peter's growing awareness of his sinfulness and how he deals with it. Okay, so in seeing the power of Christ in the miraculous catch of fish, Peter sees his sinfulness and he tells Christ to go away because he knows that holiness and sin can't stay together. But he wants to stay with Christ. And so he stays and he endures the painfulness of it. When he doesn't understand about eat my body and drink my blood, he still stays because he knows thou hast the words of life. He doesn't yet know that he is the word and he is the life, but he knows enough. He falls in the place where he was most triumphantly sure of himself. He was a courageous man. He thought he could do this. And he couldn't. And then he does the only sane thing that you can do, is he weeps. And then he does not hide from Christ. He goes to the tomb. When he finds out that the Lord, they say the Lord's risen, he doesn't run away. He goes. He accepts the pain of the healing. He by saying, yes, I love you, he understands, yes, I have denied you, but yes, I love you. He eats Christ. There's that Eucharistic meal, that meal of the fish. And this is what we all have to do. We can't be reunited to Christ if we're not eating him. He loves and tends the sheep at whatever cost to himself. And then at the end, he accepts martyrdom and humbly, and I didn't get into this part, but we all know, he asked to be crucified upside down because he was unworthy to be crucified the same way as his Lord. So at the end, he accepts martyrdom and rejoices to suffer for Christ. So going back to the three powers of the soul, when Peter is denying Christ, his noose is not yet fully clear. He's looking towards Christ the best he can, but his vision is blurry, and he's looking over his shoulder to see who's getting ready to kill him. And because of that, the two horses can't listen to the charioteer very well, even though they sort of want to. He wants to be angry at God's enemies. He wants to desire God, and he does desire God, but he doesn't yet know what that means. He doesn't yet fully know who Christ is and what it means to follow him. And then he goes through this whole process, and then at his own martyrdom, he now has, you know, as fully clear a noose as one can have in this world. And he knows that the way to fellowship with Christ is through martyrdom. And his desiring power wants to be with Christ more than it wants earthly life. And his insensitive or angering power is angry at anything that's going to keep that from happening. And that is why the martyrs could go rejoicing to their deaths, because their nooses were now fully clear, fully focused on Christ, and all their anger was directed against the right things, and all their desire was directed towards the right things, and they knew that the only way to life is death with Christ. And it's 4:15, and I'm finished with this part. So this is the first half of the talk, and then we'll have the rest of it later. Are there any questions? For anybody who didn't hear that, she was saying that when Jesus was telling Peter, you know, when you were young, you went wherever you wanted to, and when you're old, others will take you where you don't want to go. And so Mother Tabitha was saying that a lot of people relate that to just living our lives, and as we get older and can do less and less on our own. You know, I think of the absolutely amazing people I've met in nursing homes who have really allowed themselves to accept that confinement as a cross in the best sense. You know, and they live a much more ascetic life than any of us does. You know, I mean, they can't take care of their bodily functions without somebody helping. You know, and so if you have your eyes focused on Christ, then yes, that's an opportunity to turn that into an act of love for him. And if we don't have our eyes on Christ, then, you know, it just becomes too hard to bear. But, yeah, there's some amazing people out there. Yeah. Anything else? Okay.